Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99 cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
Welcome to Heritage Voices, episode 84. I'm Jessica Uquinto, and I'm your host. And today we're talking about the Boulder Ethnographic Education Project, Indigenous Perspectives on Ethnography. Before we begin, I'd like to honor and acknowledge that the lands I'm recording on today are part of the Nooch, or Ute People's Treaty Lands, the Dene Ta, and the ancestral Puebloan homeland. Today we have Erica Walters, Joseph Gazing Wolf, and Rashawn Edison on the show. And I am super excited to have this group on the podcast because this is a group that I work with. So very excited. The four of us worked together this fall on a project, the Boulder Ethnographic Education Project. And so I just had to have them on to talk about this and the other work that they're doing that's similar to this, but we'll focus on this one since this is what we worked on together. But just again, so excited to have you guys. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
Super excited.
Yeah. Okay. So how about you all introduce yourselves? Erica, do you want to start?
Yeah, sure. I'm Erica Walters. I'm an anthropologist and ethnographer. I've been working at Living Heritage for almost a year now. I live in the Philadelphia area. I'm also on the board for the American Anthropological Association's Group on Tourism and a member of the Association of Indigenous Anthropologists.
And just to clarify, that was Living Heritage Anthropology, because here in a second, we will have a different Living Heritage. So Joseph, do you want to introduce yourself?
Yes. My name is Joseph Gazing Wolf. I'm Ngapa Lakota and Amazigh and Nubian on my mother's side. I am the executive director of Living Heritage Research Council, where we do wonderful work with tribal nations to help document their stories and narratives about ancestral lands and their connection to those lands. Hello, everyone. Just a note that since the recording of this podcast, the Living Heritage Research Council has changed its name to the Heritage Lands Collective.
Perfect. And Rashawn, how about you?
Hello, everybody. My name is Rashawn Edison. I'm an ethnographer alongside Erica, going strong almost a year at Living Heritage Anthropology. Alongside that, I'm the director for Harvest of All First Nations Cultural Education and Environmental Justice Program. I currently live in the Colorado area, Denver, but my home is in Steamboat, Arizona, on Dene Ta Navajo land. And I'm super excited to be here with you all.
Yeah. Okay. So I guess I'll start by giving a super brief intro to our work at Boulder. I'm not going to go too in depth because we're working on lots of things with the city of Boulder, but just enough so that there's a little bit of context for this project. So this project, well, my involvement with the city of Boulder started back in 2018, and that came out of their Indigenous Peoples Day resolution that part of it instructed them to rename a property that was known at the time as Settlers Park. And so the city wanted to do tribal consultation work to come up with a new name for that park, among other things, and just rebuild relationships, because the city of Boulder actually had very early relationships with tribes in the 90s and 2000s. So just basically to rebuild after there had been, you know, changes of staff and everything that led to a gap in consultation. So we did that work. So that involved reaching out to 16 tribes. And we've been working since 2019 with these tribes. And one of the major parts of that, again, was the renaming of Settlers Park to the People's Crossing. And one of the things that came out of those conversations was an interest from the tribal nations that we work with on education and doing more to educate the public about their connections to that area. And when we started working on education, it was recommended that there be a ethnographic study or a cultural landscape study completed in order for their tribes to feel like they knew what they wanted to say, got to spend some time on the landscape before creating educational materials for the public. So this is the project that we're going to be talking about today. This is the project that the four of us went into the field together on last fall. And we've also, Rashawn and I have gone on an additional field visit for this project as well. So Rashawn can speak to two of those, and Erica and Joseph can speak to one visit with two separate groups of tribes that happened this fall. So yeah, so excited. Did I miss anything? Anyone want to add anything to that background real quick?
That sounds great to me.
Yeah, I think you got it all.
Yes.
Good job.
Woo. I mean, there's more happening. There's lots. The city of Boulder is doing lots of good things. Yeah, and I also just wanted to acknowledge the work of Ernest House Jr. and Nicole Miera of the Keystone Policy Center, who have been helping out with all of these different Boulder projects, Ernest House especially. And he was also a guest on Heritage Voices, episode 69. So if you want to go back and listen more about the work that Ernest House Jr. and the Keystone Policy Center are doing, it's a really great episode. Personally, yeah, I could listen to Ernest talk forever. So definitely highly recommend. And thank you to Ernest and Nicole for all of your work and partnership on all of these Boulder efforts. So I guess maybe to get us started, and this isn't one of the questions I had on my list, so sorry guys, was there anything that you like went into this project? Like, did you have any thoughts on what it was going to be? Was it the same or different as what you thought maybe? Yeah. Any thoughts there? Just throwing this out there.
I think what I would say, it wasn't something that I expected to be different, but it was something that was different than other ethnography that I've done or other ethnographic work that I've done. And that is just the logistics of this type of project, because we're working with Indigenous nations and communities who have been removed from Boulder. So we're returning to Boulder with those representatives, with tribal representatives from those communities. So we have to think about travel arrangements and meals and what hotel should we stay at and where are the bathrooms, what's the weather doing, all of those things, because generally, typically in ethnography, you go to the people who are contributing to your research. You're not necessarily traveling with them. So it's kind of an added layer of consideration. So that made this work more unique for me in my experience.
Yeah, and I think that's an excellent point too, Erica, because I think anytime you do research with Indigenous communities in particular, there's the option to either go to their context or to bring them into a context, essentially a context where they were forcibly removed, right? So I think one of the wonderful things about this project is the fact that we're bringing back folks who have a connection to these lands, you know, in every way possible, spiritually, historically, linguistically, to these contexts, and they, you know, bringing them back and having them reconnect to the land in such a deep way where they're asked to sit there and, you know, in the context and tell us about their experiences, their memories, their narratives, their stories. And that to me was just a powerful experience. And the other thing that really stood out for me, having worked with other agencies, is how wonderfully prepared Boulder was in comparison to other contexts in which we've collaborated with federal and state agencies. So really, to me, it highlights Boulder's preparation in working with tribal communities and their desire to do so and their competence in doing so. They really stood out to me among all the other agencies that I've worked with. So it was a very pleasant experience in that regard.
Could you talk about like what showed you that they were prepared, or like what, you know, I'm just thinking like if I'm working for another agency, like a state or federal, like what does it take to be prepared? You know what I mean? Like what would they need to do in order to be prepared?
Well, I mean, I don't know if others would agree with me, but it takes a lot of personal individual work in order for a group to be prepared. So what stands out about Boulder is that the individuals working there have clearly put in the time and effort to learn about the historical context of tribal removal and the grotesque history of settler colonialism here in the United States. They bothered to put in that time and effort to learn these things. And they bothered to put in the time and effort to hear tribal voices. And so it was quite clear that they had put themselves through the personal training required to do that, whether it be through the readings of books written by Indigenous people or just via experience of working with Indigenous people for many years. It was quite clear that they were there to hear the voices of the tribal reps that were there. And so, and when I talked to them one-on-one, all the individuals from Boulder City had a much higher level of consciousness as to why they're doing this work, as compared to other contexts where when I talk to the individuals from other contexts, I'm not going to mention specific agencies, but when I talk to persons from other contexts, it's the response to why are you doing this work or why are you here when I ask them that is typically, well, my boss told me to be here, or like it's a requirement, you know, our new head, our new representative, our new boss is saying that we should come here and meet with tribes, or, you know, this is just something that we do or something like that. There's no personal work that was done by the individual to raise consciousness as to why this work is important. And so they're not there purposefully, whereas Boulder clearly stood out in that regard.
All right, Rashaan, sorry, I veered away from you for a second there, but if you had something you wanted to share.
No, I think this is great because leading into this consultation work that we all worked on together with the city of Boulder, it was very interesting to me in the fact that, like Joseph had mentioned before, that they were so open and so willing to accept criticism. Right. And so when we talk about criticism, especially with the relationships with tribal nations, there is a very fine line, right, between injustice and then like perpetuating this idea and narrative of settler colonialism. Right. And so when I think about anthropology and ethnography, the story has very much has been told from a narrative that has been protected in a way that ethnographies, and especially from a Western point of view, have their own ideas of what tribal nations are and how they should be and how they're governed themselves, right? They completely ignore the fact of sovereignty. And so within this work and within the relationship that these tribal nations had with the city of Boulder has been very much different from what history has showed us in the past. And then so being a young Indigenous ethnographer, anthropologist, it's just been opening up my lens to those certain experiences that we have not seen in the past, right? And so I've been a part of consultations where whatever is being said and whatever has been done and whatever, let's say, institution with tribal nations, that relationship isn't really there. And that relationship oftentimes is very much conflicting. And so within the work that we have done, it's been the city of Boulder accepts criticism, right? And they have been very much willing to work with the suggestions that we have done within living heritage anthropology and within tribal consultation, right? And anyone who knows anything about working with tribes in this kind of consulting work, things get pretty heated, right? And being able to navigate those spaces in like a safe environment has been very much super rewarding within my spectrum of the work that we've done with the city of Boulder.
Yeah, and I should mention too that Erica and Rashaan were also involved in the tribal consultation work and some of our other work with the city. So Rashaan and Erica can also speak to the tribal consultation meetings themselves as well with all of the tribes all together. I didn't mention that at the beginning. All right, and it always flies so fast, but we're already at our first break point. So we will be right back and continue this discussion here in a second.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details. Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99 cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Okay, so we're back, and now we're really ready to dive into this. So I guess let's start with the fun one. What was all of y'all's favorite part of this project?
Yeah, I think for me, the thing that really stood out is, you know, when we grow up, those of us who grew up on the reservation, or even for folks that grew up in urban environments, you know, we don't have a lot of access to our own elders. And so, because they get 10,000 asks every week. And so, you know, they're often involved in tribal council affairs, politics, education, et cetera. And so with a lot of good work being done in terms of the revitalization of our cultures, our elders are really being pulled every which way. And so, I mean, I remember my own, the only fight I ever got into with my grandfather, the only argument I ever had with him was where I told him, like, hey, man, I'm hardly seeing you anymore. Like, we were very close, and yet you're hardly in my life anymore because you're on tribal council, you're, you know, working on buffalo restoration, you're doing all this wonderful work, but, you know, don't forget that I'm here and I need you, right? And so it's really a wonderful privilege to be able to get to spend time with tribal elders from any context in any community. It's a real privilege. And so I want to acknowledge that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Definitely. I would like echo that same thing and saying it feels like such an enormous privilege to be present on these visits, or returns rather, of people to a place they've been removed from. And then the fact that we not only get to be there and be with these elders, but that we also get to do ethnography in those moments is incredible. And the tribal representatives share so much, and they're so generous with their knowledge in a setting where they have every right to be almost bitter, right? Like, a couple hundred years ago, Boulder was trying to eliminate Indigenous people, and now Boulder's going back to these same communities and asking them for help. And it seems like that could be a potentially unpleasant situation, but it's not. And that's because of the tribal representatives that are working on this project. They're so gracious. They're so committed to educating people. They're willing to do all of this work, and it's not easy, but I'm so endlessly impressed and so grateful for all of the tribal representatives and elders involved.
I share the same exact feeling as my colleagues right here. Oh my gosh, just working with elders that come from tribal nations from far near the Boulder, Denver area has been such a privilege to work with, especially growing up on the reservation, right? When I had my grandparents and their cousins, and I had a lot of grandmas, right? And I had a lot of grandpas growing up. And now it seems like as I enter this field of anthropology and ethnography, a lot of these stories that we hear and that we are recording and we're helping keep that narrative alive that these tribal representatives want is such a privilege for me, because a lot of times now within the current age, a lot of our elders are leaving really early, and being Indigenous leaders within the community, we need their voices more than ever, right? And so to be able to work with alongside tribal representatives and the city of Boulder has been an amazing blessing and a privilege. And just because, well, also because I'm a resident of Colorado now, and I've lived in Denver for about 5 years. And so understanding the history between settler colonialism and Indigenous peoples is something that Native people have to face on a daily basis if they live in urban environments, especially within Colorado area or wherever we go, right? Because wherever we are on stolen land, just to echo what my colleagues have said. And to know those histories and to grapple with it in an institutional setting, right, on the county level, on the city level, is that much more rewarding for me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and just to give a little bit more context to some of what they're talking about, and I think one thing that Erica maybe was specifically referring to is that, but basically that a group of soldiers from Boulder, they trained in Boulder, and then they went and participated in the Sand Creek Massacre down in Southwest Colorado against Cheyenne and Arapaho people, children all the way through elders, men and women. And so obviously that would be something that would be real easy to be very bitter and really hold against the city. And I will say that the city is doing quite a bit of work specifically on that topic. There's a property called the Four Chambers Poor Farm property that they're working with the tribes, specifically the Cheyenne and Arapaho, who are the Sand Creek descendant tribes, on what to do with that property where the soldiers did train before going down to Sand Creek. And so, yeah, with that in mind, like all of you said, not even just coming and being generous, but my God, the laughter. I love it. It's always such a fun, good time in addition to the privilege and the responsibility that weighs heavy too on getting all of this right. But I'd say my favorite part, and this is one that I've heard our colleague at the city give us an example of his most meaningful moment as well, where we were talking with one of the tribal representatives who brought their family with them on this visit. And, you know, them saying that when you all first reached out in 2018, we didn't know you. We didn't know what you wanted. We were very unsure. But, you know, now you're family. And that was just, you know, you can't surpass a moment like that. So that was mine, I think. All right. What about, and all of you have worked on other ethnographic projects too. So if you want to bring in something you've seen just in Boulder or across different projects, but what it would have been some learning moments in doing this kind of work for all of you?
I think across all of the projects that we do, including the Boulder ethnographic education work, is, again, it's just so incredible and inspiring to see just the Herculean amount of work that these tribal elders do for their people and for agencies and cities like the city of Boulder. A lot of our representatives are elders and they're engaging in projects like this. They're traveling while they're also running entire offices, juggling the responsibilities that would typically be handled by like three or more people. And it's really their commitment to their people and improving like the cultural and spiritual and mental and physical well-being of their communities, because this type of work can lead to really tangible outcomes in those areas. So just the work ethic alone of the tribal representatives is inspiring and motivates me to do more.
Yeah. And the fact that they're doing it at that age, right? I mean, I'm a fairly young man, generally speaking, and I get tired. And yet they're, you know, they're often driving far distances and still in such good spirit and humor. And yeah, like you mentioned, Jessica, that's like one of my favorite things is the fact that, you know, anytime we're around elders and especially if any aunties are there, we know there's going to be some really funny jokes that are going to be drawn. So yeah. And Erica's point, you know, that their work ethic is just incomparable. So it really, like, I enjoy being there. My favorite part is just being with them because I get to absorb so much of their spirit of honest work. Honest humanity really is what it comes down to, right? They wear their hearts on their sleeves. They're honest with their words, which is not something, I'm sorry to say, it's not something that's part of settler colonial culture in general. And so it's such a refreshing thing to be in an environment where humans are acting like humans, right? And that's very uncomfortable for us, isn't it? Because, you know, it doesn't matter that, you know, a lot of these elders are not my elders and they don't know me from Adam. So when they show up, I have to earn their respect and trust like everybody else, right? So it puts me in an uncomfortable position just as much as anybody else, because again, there's a genuine human interaction taking place where they don't know me, they don't know what our organization is or what we've done in many regards, right? Except for those who have worked with us for a long period of time. And so, you know, we have to earn their trust and we have to respect their boundaries and make sure that we're following, you know, very, very proper protocols when we're approaching them and doing this work. And so, there's plenty of times where I trip over my own feet. And, you know, if you're working with a specific elder or a specific tribe, they might have different protocols than the one that you were just with the, you know, a few days ago. And so you're going to make mistakes. And it's important to recognize those mistakes, to say, hey, like, teach me how to do this properly, right? I care about you. I want you to be here. I want to keep doing this work. Teach me how to respect you the proper way within your context. And so, you know, it's for all of, like, you're, for me, my experience has been like learning to be human again, right? It's learning my own humanity, my own limitations, and recognizing that those limitations when the opportunity presents itself.
The conversations like these remind me of like subtle things, or not subtle things, like things that were very much a part of my everyday life growing up with my grandparents, that like trickle into the work that we're doing now. For example, it would be like, I always have this mentality wherever I go because of the teachings of my grandpa. He always used to tell me, wherever Native people are, you're going to have family. And wherever Native people are, you're going to make community, right? And so I find this like very much a part of my life wherever I go, in any social gathering, whether that's ceremony, powwows, council meetings, right? Wherever there's Native people, there's going to be that kinship and that community factor. And because I grew up within the teachings of my grandparents, and I like was raised by my grandparents, meeting these tribal elders that do this incredible work within their communities and that are willing to travel out far distances to give a little bit of their perspective, their knowledge, right? It reminds me of these leaders that I grew up within my communities, right? These are the leaders within other tribal communities that just came all together in one. And so in that viewpoint, I'm very much privileged, right? Because I can see my elders literally come to the forefront in the work that we're doing and that we have done with the city of Boulder. And I've heard it from multiple staff from the city of Boulder saying that this is an experience that they never have witnessed, right? And people who come from the reservation or like tribal backgrounds, that's very much a part of their lives a lot of the times. And that's very much have been my case within this work. But that community, that kinship that extends beyond blood, and because like these worldviews that all these indigenous people are coming together, they're very much similar, but at the same time, they have their very own unique niche in the way they view and see and experience the world, right? And we just get a glimpse of it, like just a very small glimpse within the work that we do here. And the fact that a lot of the tribal representatives that I have worked with in the past and continue to work on within the work that we do within Boulder, I've actually been called nephew, right, a couple of times. And I can actually say I have aunties and I have uncles that I've met through this work, right, within tribal preservation offices and their TIPO officers and the community members that they have brought to the table. That it's just been super amazing.
So to add to what some of you guys are all saying, I've said this before on the podcast, I'll say it a million times, but if anyone wants to support the efforts of the TIPOs and these elders that are just way overstretched, please contact your congresspeople and let them know that you think that the Historic Preservation Fund needs additional funding for Tribal Historic Preservation Office. That would be huge because they are way underfunded, especially compared to the state historic preservation offices. A lot of the tribes have connections to much larger reaches of land than the states do. There's vastly more tribes than states, and they receive much less funding than the states do. Mm-hmm. So if you want to really make a difference, you know, for heritage preservation, for cultural preservation, for these elders specifically, but also for, you know, these projects where people are looking for input from tribes and there's the TIPO offices are just too overstaffed in order to give that feedback, that would be really helpful for the agencies and would help move projects through faster and things like that. Again, reach out to your congresspeople and let them know that you'd like the Tribal Historic Preservation Officer portion of the Historic Preservation Fund increased. All right, yes. Off my soapbox.
Yep. Write those letters.
Yes. Yeah, write those letters. Yep. All right. We are going to go into our second break, and then we will come back and finish talking about this project and what we've all learned. Okay. And we're back again. And so obviously we've talked about all the happy, shiny, good things about this project and other projects. What have been some challenges that have come up doing ethnographic work for the three of you?
I think there are two, especially for scholars and students that are listening to this, I think there are two important things to raise here. One is the context in which this work is taking place. So we have to acknowledge the history that has taken place here, the historical context where, you know, we're working with communities that have had several attempts at erasure, right? The cultural erasure, physical, linguistic, language, et cetera. I mean, in every way, they've been removed from the land and removed from history. And there are many forces at work now trying to remove them from history books altogether. And so, you know, these folks are willing to come into a context that has historically been incredibly antithetical to their very existence. So we have to recognize that. And so, like I said earlier, you know, we do our best to follow proper protocol to welcome them in as relatives and as loved ones. And we make sure that we try to educate our federal, state, and city partners to approach in a respectful manner, to recognize that historical context taking place. And so I would urge any scholars that are doing similar work or hope to do similar work to understand the context in which you're working and the extreme discomfort that these elders and tribal reps are putting themselves in order to be there. And the other thing, to be more specific to anthropologists, I work broadly. I work with indigenous nations all over the world, and I was in Ecuador this summer, working with Quechua and Waurani people and learning the Quechua and Waurani language. And the elders that were teaching me Quechua started talking about anthropologists because the primary people that they've had contact with who are scholars been anthropologists. And I was curious. So I asked, you know, what's the Quechua word for anthropologist? And there isn't one. They said Yuyana. And I said, wait a second. Yuyana is the word for liar. and they're like, yep, that's the word that we use for anthropologists. So, you know, this history of imposing one's viewpoints on indigenous people, studying them like lab rats, and then imposing, you know, a Western settler colonial cultural perspective on their world and viewpoint is just pervasive throughout anthropology and other areas of scholarship. And so you need to understand that you are, if you're an anthropologist, especially if you're a settler colonial anthropologist, if you're non-Indigenous, you are the face of cultural genocide. You are the face of, you know, you represent a field and a context that has tried historically to erase these people, their language, their history, and their culture. And so you need to come in with that consciousness and make sure that you're approaching these people not just respectfully, but that you approach them with absolute understanding of what human dignity requires of you in that context and do honest scholarship, right? So these two points are really important for any anthropologist and especially students and future scholars to understand.
Yeah, I think Joseph brings out really excellent points around ethics. And I think most, you know, all anthropologists are educated in academia, right? So they're learning how to do anthropology, usually, unless you're at a really cool progressive school, usually from other non-native people. So if you're looking to do anthropology with indigenous groups, just like Joseph said, you really need to understand the context in which you're working. And you also need to reconsider things that you've been taught about ethics. Because, you know, I was always taught in school by non-native people, oh, you get the informed consent form and you're good to go. But that is not culturally relevant with indigenous groups. You have to think about the ethics of the people with whom you're working. And like something like consent is revocable and temporary, and you need to be checking in and you need to have a collaborative process, and you can't be extractionist, and you have to think about the tangible ways in which you've been taught to do anthropology and decolonialize them, not to use such a buzzword, but really be mindful about how you do this work. And I think that it is hard for people to do this work ethically if you don't know the people that you're working with well, or you're not, you know, exposed to cultural norms. And there's a lot of pre-work and conversations and life experience that I think you need to have in order to do this work in a way that is ethical and mindful and mutually benefits, you know, all of the parties involved. But you always want to make sure that your research contributors in this context, it would be the tribal representatives and the tribal nations and communities, that they're benefiting from it the most. And they're always your first priority is protecting them and prioritizing their wants and needs.
Yeah, I think that's an excellent point, Erica, that a lot of these Western standards of ethics just simply are incredibly foreign to us, right? In our context. And so, you know, if there's one way that I can relate, you know, an indigenous concept to a Western audience, I would say, you know, approach these people like they're your family, right? If you understand, you know, if you're comfortable with somebody speaking over your grandmother when she's speaking, okay. If you're like, okay, you know, there's something seriously wrong with you, but you know, if you have healthy relationships with your family members, you know, you wouldn't want somebody to smother their culture and their language and their voice for their own. And so, and you would want to check in with them regularly to make sure that they're still comfortable with what's going on. Right. So that incredibly important point you made, Erica, of like, informed consent is not a one time and you're done kind of thing. You check in regularly to see, are you still okay with what's happening here? Are you okay with sharing this? In what context are you okay sharing this, et cetera, et cetera? And another thing that it's important to highlight is, if you're doing this to further your own career as a scholar, that's okay. Just let people know exactly how you're going to be using information and in what way and in what manner and how it's going to benefit you. You need to let them know this very clearly and engage in that dialogue regularly with the indigenous folks that you're working with. I've seen it many times. I mean, we know this story over and over, right? People go in, they extract knowledge, nothing comes back to the community. They further their own academic careers and they go away and never relate to the community again. This cannot keep happening. So what we're trying to stand for, both at Living Heritage Anthropology and at the Living Heritage Research Council, is we're trying to give a counterexample to that. We're trying to show what actual research that is honest, that is indigenous led, looks like. And it's a good example to follow, and hopefully people listen to this and kind of take some important points out of it and incorporate it into their own approach.
Any other challenges or things that you would want people to know?
And I think one other point, if I may share, the point about consciousness is really important, because a lot of people can read books and understand. In fact, I've talked to some of my white colleagues at the university, and some of them are familiar with all kinds of the latest research and thinking on settler colonialism, and they're very well versed in this and that other author and this and that theory, and yet you know, when you observe them in context working with tribal nations, they commit every settler colonial, typical settler colonial approach. They commit all these mistakes of speaking over and smothering the voices of natives, the natives they're working with. So the really important point to drive home here is you have to be mindful in the moment that you're practicing what you understand intellectually. Because I've been in contexts where, like, I'll just give a quick example, and sorry I'm taking so much time, but you know, we were in a meeting that was all about how to recognize the communities that we're working with as academics. So we had this big meeting at the university where we broke out into individual sessions talking about how to recognize the local communities that we're working with in our research and in our research presentations. And one of my colleagues from the lab I was working with at the time was leading one of these discussions. She was the leader of one of these discussions. We go from that meeting to a lab meeting where the same person who is leading that discussion is talking about her work with indigenous nations in Senegal. And she doesn't mention at all any of the local community members or local women that Senegalese Wolof women that she worked with there that made her research possible. She doesn't mention them by name. And so I point out, because the whole presentation was her giving her presentation to practice with the lab before she gives it publicly. And so it was our job as her co-lab members to give her criticism. And so I speak up and I say, hey, you didn't mention the local communities that you're working with at all. You didn't acknowledge them at all in your presentation. And she was extremely offended that I gave her that feedback. Literally 2 minutes prior to that, she was leading a talk about how to get, you know, so there's all kinds of, it's really important that you're mindful in the context, that you're mindful in the moment of what you're doing, because otherwise it doesn't matter what knowledge you hold in your head. If you're not practicing in context, it's worthless.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I think we've all seen that moment of white fragility happen.
Yeah, I think that's something that's really unique to applied anthropology. And what's really special about doing field work is that you actually have to embody anthropology and embody the ethics of the people that you're working with in a way that's different from people, from anthropologists who are professors or who just work in academia or who only do, you know, research in their offices. We call them armchair anthropologists often. So that's one of the awesome benefits of doing applied work and actually being in the field, is that you get to embody the practice in a way that you actually get to practice what you preach a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'd echo what some of you were already saying, in that in order to be an anthropologist, you have to go to these academic programs that train you in one way. And then in order to be successful as an anthropologist, like as a, you know, a collaborative community-based anthropologist, you have to unlearn half of what you were then taught in the academic setting. And so, like, for example, like Joseph, you mentioned, you know, how you would treat your grandmother, but like actually the way I would treat my grandmother is pretty different than the way I would treat an indigenous elder, in the sense of, like, for my grandmother, like, it's respectful if you were like asking questions and like stuff like that. Whereas like I had to learn that, like, oh, that's actually not showing that I'm like listening and being respectful. So, like, I think there's also, you know, like, there's like basic forms of respect, but then there's also being aware that, you know, it's not like these are white people that you add some dances and beads to, and then, you know, it's like,
yeah. Well, and this is an example of trying to speak across worlds, right?
Right.
Walking in different worlds. I mean, I don't know how to communicate it to settler culture, to say, like, to relate it to a personal experience. So maybe you have a different perspective that's a better way to relate it. But yeah, even saying that, relate to these folks like they're your family, I'm still using an indigenous perspective to say that, right? Because I'm relating right to them like my family. And I, you know, and for me, that means something as an indigenous person. But yeah, that, you're right. I mean, it's, you have to be very careful to say that, because people treat their family differently depending on their,
I mean, yeah, no, it's just a lot of, for my, you know, experience, it was a lot of just being aware and paying attention to what's happening around you, noticing where there's discomfort, you know, asking about it, receiving that criticism as, you know, not being about you, but about the work itself and making it better, you know, not going into that white fragility moment, but recognizing that it's not about you. So, but it is about you, like, taking that and making things better. I think that's which, I mean, it's a long, hard, continuous, I'm still going through it every day process. I wish there was an easy look. This is what you do. Done.
Yeah. And I think you really touched it there, Jessica, because the one thing that really stands out when I think every Indigenous person could probably relate to this. The one thing that stands out about interacting with non-Indigenous folks is that anything you talk about will somehow be spun to be made about them. And it might be central to the culture, right? And individualistic culture, it's all about the individual, right? So that might be just inherent to the culture, but it's really destructive when it takes place where people are interacting with Indigenous people, right? To kind of recenter what the Indigenous person is saying, or the stories they're telling, or the context that they're in, and kind of redirect it at you to highlight yourself. That's something that I would encourage my Western friends to be very conscious of.
Yeah. Anybody have any additional like advice or things that you know, from Boulder, but from your other work as well, about how to do this work and how to do it better?
Yeah, I would say the like just first thing across all my work that I would encourage people, if they want to do this work or if they're just interested in it, the first thing they should do is to think about their homes and where they live and who was dispossessed of that area so that it could be used by non-Native people. Because just like Rashawn said earlier, everyone is on Native land, on stolen land. So I think the first step in educating yourself is to understand whose land you're on and to learn that history so that you can be a more conscious member of society. Yeah, that would be my first piece of advice.
What I will say in some of my other practices within being an ethnographer and an anthropology, even in like coming from an Indigenous background, right, where like everything is so communal and like egalitarian in a way, which is like very far from egalitarian, but still in that kind of realm, it's super easy to come off as arrogant, and it's super easy to come off as a know-it-all if you come from a Western perspective to Indigenous peoples. Like, no matter what kind of conversation, no matter what kind of project, if you come from a worldview that is much like Western culture to Indigenous people, you're going to come off as arrogant. You're going to come off as ignorant, right? And within like the awe-inspiring work that I see within a lot of the elders and tribal representatives that we have worked with, right? They deal with that constantly. They deal with that all the time. And the fact that they're giving you the time and day for us to be a part of their lives, it makes that so much more valuable in the aspect that these people have PhDs in their culture. They have PhDs in their language, which is intergenerational, which a modern day professor, a PhD scholar will never be able to comprehend, right? And will never be able to be on that kind of level. And they don't need those titles. And so those are the kind of like, if I were to give advice and viewpoints, is we look up to our elders as if they have PhDs. And it's higher than PhDs, right? Yeah. Super easy to be ignorant. Period.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think thinking about this work with Boulder specifically, I think that's one thing that I was excited about was the city of Boulder's willingness to like listen and learn and to say like, hey, we don't know what we're doing at all. We don't know anything. We're asking you for this. We know it's a big ask. And they demonstrate their commitment to that by allocating a lot of resources to this work. Like they're allocating time, people, money, like Joseph said, not only the city of Boulder, but the individual people involved are dedicating time to this and to learn about the past. So that is directly related to the impactful and meaningful outcomes that they will get out of this. So other advice I would say is I would encourage other cities in the United States and Canada and wherever to look at the work that Boulder is doing as kind of a blueprint for how this work can be done and why it's important to do, because the city is getting a lot out of this work. They are really benefiting from it. This isn't like charity work. This is something that everyone is doing for the city, and it is also mutually benefiting the tribes. So this is something that has great mutual benefits for Indigenous nations, the city, us, obviously, as anthropologists, like we've been talking about. But I think that every city in the United States could could benefit from this. And if there are any cities listening who'd like to do it, you could send Living Heritage an email and we'd be happy to help you out.
Mm-hmm. There you go. Well, and I want to say too, like, how much of an honor it's been to work with the three of you and how much I've learned from the three of you and how much I appreciate, you know, just the spirit of this group and like everybody's willingness to just like jump in and get it done and do it right and care for the people that we're working with and care for each other. Like, I can't tell you how much I appreciate, like, for example, Joseph, I was really having an off day during one of our intro meetings and Joseph really like jumped in and saved the day because I was flustered from moving from one thing to another really quickly. And I just really appreciate like how much this group is willing to have real honest conversations and to do whatever needs to be done to do the job well. So I appreciate the three of you so much.
But that highlights a really important point, Jessica, because, you know, one of the things that makes it such a pleasure to work with you is that you wear your humanity on your shoulders, right? So you wear it on your face. I mean, the fact that you've been doing this work for way longer than I mean, professionally, you've been doing this work for way longer than I've even come close to. And yet you, on many occasions, you stop and say, hey, did I do that right? Do you have any recommendations, right? I'm like, you're asking me. You are asking me. So the fact that you approach this with humility is the reason that these people trust you and call you family, right? It always comes down to understanding that you are a guest, that you are there to learn their ways and to elevate their voices as much as you can from your podium, right? And that you are going to make mistakes, you're going to have bad days, and to approach it as the human in heart that you are is so important. And the bolder individuals that we worked with, the reason they're such a pleasure to work with is the same thing. I mean, I had several of the folks that were there, you know, they would do something, they would say something, they would, you know, engage with the tribal reps, and then they would come up to me individually, kind of take me to the side and say, hey, did I do that right? Do you think I could have made it better? I mean, just the fact that they're humble enough to do that speaks volumes as to all, you know, what where your hearts are and what your intentions are.
All right. Any last thoughts? Anybody have anything they've been itching to say?
Not really. I'm just happy to be a part of this. I'm glad we got to do this. I love working with all of you, just echoing all of a lot of Joseph's sentiments as well. Even just like Jessica, even just like having this podcast, you know, and having this opportunity for people to talk about their work is awesome.
Yeah. What I really hope is after we finish this report and it's like out in the public, because that is the goal of this report, for it to be a public document. And that was decided by the tribes that we work with. So my hope is it'd be really awesome once that's, you know, out in the public, that maybe we can have some of the reps that we work with come on the podcast and share the experience from their perspective. That'd be really cool.
That would be awesome.
All right.
I'm looking forward to the Ethnographic Report podcast part 2. Which reps? It's gonna be great.
Yes. It's gonna be awesome. All right. Well, thank you all so much for coming and taking all this time and sharing with everybody. And just so excited and honored that I get to keep working with all of you and hopefully many, many more projects. So thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Heritage Voices podcast. You can find show notes at www.archaeologypodcastnetwork.com/heritagevoices. Please subscribe to the show on iTunes, Stitcher, or the Google Play Music Store. Also, please share with your friends or write us a review. Sharing and reviewing helps more people find the show and gets the perspectives of Heritage Voices' amazing guests out there into the world. Don't we just need more of that in anthropology and land management? If you have any more questions, comments, or show suggestions, please reach out to me at jessica@livingheritageanthropology.org. If you'd like to volunteer to be on the show as a guest or even a co-host, reach out to me as well, jessica@livingheritageanthropology.org. You can also follow more of what I'm doing on Facebook at Living Heritage Anthropology and the nonprofit Living Heritage Research Council, or on Twitter at Living Heritage A. As always, huge thank you to Lyle Belenqua and Jason Nez for their collaboration on our incredible logo.
this episode was produced by Chris Webster from his RV traveling the United States, Tristan Boyle in Scotland, DigTech LLC, Cultural Media, and the Archaeology Podcast Network, and was edited by Rachel Roden.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.